Reading from the Brihadbhagavatamrita, Chapter 7, Text 5. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Samstapya yatna ratmanam swastyam janayatum prabho vipayam chintayam asyat kapta chan natkaram vidhi. With difficulty, Brahma brought himself under control and started thinking of how to restore his Lord to normal. Soon an idea came into his heart. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnanam Jnana Silakaya Daksur Unmulatam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Vairagya Bhakti Visham Priyatnai Apayama Manabipsamandam Kripambuhiya Paraduka Duki Sanatanastam Prabhumastriyami Vansha Kalpa Tirubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vaedhacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Nama. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Vedadha Sri Vasudeva Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Excuse me, a little dry here. Greetings from Govardhan. We just celebrated Govardhan Puja. So nice. Parikram means to go around, but it's more a matter of consciousness than movement. And circumambulation is one of the practices of devotional service. Devotional service, the principle is to remember God, to remember Krishna, and the mind also follows the body. That's why when you bow down, it's not just a physical act, it's an act of consciousness. When you pay obeisances, your head goes down, your heart goes up. Sometimes a humble person bows from the waist. It's also connected to consciousness. So going around Govardhan is putting the divine in the center and putting yourself in the consciousness as either you're walking around or paying your obeisances around. Putting yourself in the consciousness that you're the object of God's desires. You're the servant of God. So, I mean, people do it in different levels of consciousness. I always like to see these old sadhus that go around Vrindavan, go around Vrindavan every day. I see one man, I mean, struggling, but he's made the vrata, the vow, that I will do this. That brings to the platform's intelligence, where you make a decision on doing things not based on how you feel, but whether or not it's good for you. So man wants to go back to Godhead, wants to perfect his life, and they make a decision that if I go around Govardhan Hill twice a day, how beneficial that will be for me, this chanting. So even though there's so much difficulty, you see people of character that they follow principles no matter how difficult it is. And there is really something special about Govardhan. You know, I've been here and I have a modest nambrata, and you're sitting there with your beads in your mind for hours and hours a day. And naturally, you want some taste. Taste comes from feeling. The most important thing is chanting is to somehow feel mercy. And of course, to feel mercy takes a quality of humility. But one way to feel mercy is that you pray and try to remember those who have touched your heart, those who have extended kindness to you. And if you can remember that kindness, it would put one in a very humble consciousness that allows one to feel mercy and feel the holy name. So it takes time to work one's consciousness into that position where there's that feeling, that taste of love that comes from the consciousness of a humble soul. The consciousness of the soul who has the understanding, the determination, the attraction to give his consciousness to Krishna. But I see, although there's so much effort, mercy is required. And I had that experience the other day. One principle of chanting is really you should think of others before yourself. Self-centered, narcissistic, prideful person. Can't have taste in chanting. But at the same time, because as a Vaishnav monk, I spend most of the year for others, it's very, very healthy, and it's recommended in the tradition that one spends at least a month for himself. Actually, for God, but for himself, his own self-purification. And you can't, when you do Namvrata, you can't be social, you can't be external. It takes time to enter deeply. It takes time to become absorbed. That's why in the three levels of samadhi, the three levels of yoga, which is dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, which are progressive stages of deeper and deeper remembrance, they're also called samana. They're also mentioned as one thing. Because the sage never just goes into samadhi. It's like turning a car. You can't test the pedal and start at 70 miles an hour. It's always got to go from 0 to 70. So even a sage who's very, very adept at meditation, he has to dharana dhyan samadhi, like an engine revving, till he gets that concentration. So it takes time to get concentration. And often, yesterday was Govardhan Puja. I mean, so many people and so many people I knew. So it's a little bit distracting to the inner life. But anyway, I try to give myself this month my consciousness, my attention, my service to the holy name of Krishna. It's actually quite a wonderful thing. It really focuses a very, very powerful light on your own soul. And you can really see anatta, the things that are not valuable. And when you see anatta, the things that are not valuable to your spiritual life and your endeavoring for spiritual life, you can taste a drop of humility. So I'm staying and I'm trying to concentrate, and then I got a phone call from someone from New York who I met just before I left, asking me if I can help him in Vrindavan. And you know, I consider that a very important service of mine, that people who come to the Holy Dham by the mercy of Srimati, the unbounded mercy of Srimati Radharani, shouldn't miss the experience, and I should help them. So about 5 or 6 people came out here, and I took them around Govardhan. And we have beautiful kirtan because, you may have seen in New York, Janavi, she sings beautiful, and her sister were there, and oh my God, did they sing beautiful. And we went, you know, around the hill, we did, you know, kirtan half the time, and absorption, and then we went into the village of Aniyur, and we did Madhukari. The sadhus, if you ever want to come and, you know, a renounced person, and just chant Hare Krishna. Radha Kund or any ashram, they give you a little room. So then what do you need is food. You don't have money. What do? You walk around the hill, and you go to the houses of Brahmins, and you go, Radhe, Radhe. And they smile, and they're cooking every day for 20, 30 people. And different sadhus come. So years ago, this Brahmin man saw me chanting at Govinda Kut and begged me to come to his house. So finally I got around to it. So I came with 6 people, and they were so excited. They brought us upstairs. They sat us down for a meal, even though we just had breakfast. So swabhavika bhakti, just natural in their heart. Really inspiring, natural in their heart. And you cannot imagine what a bridge bhakti roti chapati taste tot would be. It was just phenomenal. Anyway, we walked around, we did cure, but I noticed the profound effect that had on my consciousness. Profound effect. And I just surmise it's the dust. It's mystical. It really is. It's really mystical. The dust of Vrindavan. So we did that. And then on Govardhan Puja, which was the next day, just watch the pilgrims. It's an ocean. It's of devotion. It's waves of devotion. It's a river of people chanting and going around Govardhan Hill. So the atmosphere really becomes surcharged with devotion. So very wonderful to be here in Vrindavan and Govardhan at this time. Now we'll get to this story here, and it says Brahma brought himself under control and started to think of how to restore the Lord to normal. Now remember, this story is Narada's search for the topmost recipient of Krishna's mercy. He's looking for those who have the most forceful love. He wants that sangha, that association. That is the key to spiritual life. Sangha is the key. When you're with a devotee who is fixed in Krishna consciousness, the process of bhakti becomes so clear and illuminated. I feel like that in Govardhan, associating with devotees who are fixed in devotion. It just becomes so clear. So it's really, for someone who is serious on the spiritual path, they have to seek Sadhu Sangha. And of course, Sadhu Sangha has three aspects. Person should be more advanced than us. Person should be swajatiya, like-minded. And sneha, the person should have some relationship with us. Because after all, we are trying, our sangha is to develop bhakti. And bhakti comes from relationship. And first that relationship is with the devotee. That's how bhakti develops. A friend of mine was just mentioning, even some of these very older devotees who just somehow or other, very senior ones, who struggled in life, but the only thing that they had spiritually is a relationship with Prabhupada, whom they loved dearly. It's a very significant thing for bhakti, regardless of whatever else happens. And I'm not saying that it's not good to be fixed in Krishna consciousness, but that type of relationship is significant because that's how we develop our devotion for God. So Narada is on this search, and we know he's going to be pretty upset because he's the one that's looking for the topmost devotee. And because of his search, this discussion that ensues in the palace of Dwarka where Krishna is about the suffering of the residents of Vrindavan in Krishna's absence. So Narada is going to feel bad because when Krishna hears how much they're suffering, he actually becomes devastated. He's listening as Balaram is describing the pitiful condition of the residents of Vrindavan because they have the most attachment, they have the most pain in separation. They're wanting to die. They're withering away. Not only that, the whole Vrindavan is being told, is withering away in his absence. And then how much the cows are just suffering. And what to speak of the cows, the bushes, everything. And when Krishna, he kind of looks at his brother Balaram for some older brother, for some confirmation. And Balaram just begins to cry. And in a choked up voice, he begins to explain. And then Krishna is so moved by their deep suffering, he grabs on to the neck of Balaram as just some type of support for the emotional devastation he's going through. When those we love the most are suffering so much, we have some glimpses in this world sometimes with some types of infatuation or maybe even some deep relationships where we have some affection for someone and if it's really deep, we suffer if those people suffer. So Krishna begins to sob in his own sonorous voice. Everything, you know, the beauty of Krishna. We have some kind of conception, some types of images, but it's so startling. I mean, every day I like this at 1 o'clock after, I guess, quite a full morning of chanting. I do like to go over. So I walk for about 5 minutes, and then some of the senior Vaishnavas are congregating. And we're reading Sarati Darshana, the commentary on the 10th canto by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. And he's describing when Krishna enters into Mathura, and after a morning of chanting, you can hear very, very clearly, and you can really see the allurement, the beauty of Krishna, how much his everything, from his fragrance to his voice to his form to his personality. Vallabha Acharya wrote that beautiful song, Madhuram, Madhuram, Adharam, Madhuram, Venu, Madhuram, Gati, Madhuram. Everything about Krishna is sweet. Sweet. It's a form of, an expression of love and pleasure. It's just a beautiful thing. But you get that image and he's walking. And in class, he kept on describing Krishna like an elephant, walking like an elephant. And then I brought up the question to the assembled Vaishnavas, why do they describe Krishna as an elephant? And nice answer. Because an elephant has a swagger. Those of you who have been to India, if you see an elephant has a swagger, it has a certain confidence. So you have that image of Krishna and Balaram and their exquisite, absolute beauty coming into Mathura, and the allurement, the attraction becomes overpowering for anybody that sees them, especially the ladies of Mathura, who've heard something about Krishna but hadn't seen Krishna before. And they get dressed in a hurry. They put the top parts on the bottom parts on the top parts. And they just come running to the roof to see Krishna enter into. So Krishna's voice, everything is Krishna. Everything is all attractive. And it's a beautiful conception of the absolute truth. I love when Prabhupada says that God doesn't have the defect of impersonality. And therefore, Krishna is aptly described in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu as Akila Rasamrita Murti, the full embodiment of loving relationships. We have this concept of the absolute reality who enjoys pleasure. And that pleasure is love. But to relish love, you must also love. Your pleasure of feeling love is dependent on your love for the person who is loving you. So Krishna is not only enjoying love, he is intensely loving his devotees. And that's the supremacy of God, is his loving dealings. That's so beautifully presented in the previous purport where it says, Brahma is not just the main engineer of universal creation, but is also an infinite loving servant of the Supreme Lord. And that Supreme Lord himself is not just the ultimate origin of creation. He's not limited to to the boss, but also the greatest loving servant of his devotee. If he didn't have that aspect, how would he be supreme? Even in this world, the topmost person is not the person with the most money or the most power. The topmost person is the person who has the most loving heart. And this conception, this theological conception, does not deny this in the absolute reality. And therefore, it is very specially beautiful to hear about divinity in its full manifestation. We discussed this today in class. It was a very nice point that when Krishna entered into the wrestling arena, it was a beautiful scene too, because there's these incredibly powerful wrestlers and Kamsa plans that they'll challenge Krishna and kill him. So Krishna says, I'm just a little boy, just a young man. This is not fair. You're very powerful wrestlers. One time I was on Parikram, and those of you who come to India must come to me, come with me to Barsana. It is the sweetest place imaginable, and the people are the sweetest because they are Sneadika Radha. They have more affection for Radha. It makes them very soft. These people are very, very special. They don't, it's like going back in time, because these people live in such a beautiful, secluded place that they live in the consciousness that they are in Radharani's village and that it's not historical. But she's there now. They live in that mood. Very simple-hearted. So I was coming up from Krishnakund in Dahavan, Radharani's forest. And there's a little house on the top of the kund. And when I come around, I see the main guru of Barsana, a wonderful sadhu called Ramesh Baba. I've taken many of you to see him. And he's sitting on a chair, he has children sitting on his lap, and the whole like room, porch, it's kind of like a covered veranda, kind of, but open. It's open. There are at least 100 of his disciples, simple Bijbasi, sitting there watching television. And the television show, which was on India, was a recreation of Krishna's pastimes. I like the liberality of Ramesh Baba. He's sitting there, and when commercials go on, they turn off the TV and they have kirtan. He doesn't watch the commercials. But the scene was Krishna and Balaram coming into the wrestling arena, and people in the audience, like his father Vasudev or Kura, they would stand up in the audience and say, Anyaya. Nyaya means logic or fair, not fair. Krishna is only a small child. How can? And then another one says, Anyaya, this is not fair. And then you see the audience, you see the people in the arena. It's almost like a rebellion, and Kamsa is like looking around. And people are starting to go, Anyaya, 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 not fair. And then Kamsa, a very powerful demoniac king, stands up and says, Anyaya, not fair? That boy lifted up Govardhan Hill with the pinky of his hand for 7 days. He killed the mile-long Agasura python. And he starts telling, he says, so Anyaya, not fair? Nyaya! He gives it, it's fair. The wrestling should go on. Anyway, the conception here is that Krishna came into the wrestling arena according to a person's relationship with Krishna. They saw him to more or lesser degrees. The mother saw him as an incapable child. Kamsa saw him as fear personified, death personified. The lady saw him as the most beautiful lover. So, according to their relationship, they saw. And it's like the sun. It's like the sun at dawn. There's heat and light, but there's a faint reflection of it. Or the sun on a cloudy day, there's heat and light, but a faint reflection of it. So the concept here is, there is a supreme absolute reality that remains hidden when he has to rule as the creator, because it's only appropriate for him to show his majesty and not his intimate loving side. So the majority of the manifestation of God is hidden by his position. But here is very, very intimate, because Krishna is crying. It means that his heart and his love and who he is as a loving person is manifest without restriction. The full view. And therefore, when it describes the original Swarup of God, he's Kishore Krishna, Krishna the lover of the gopi, because it's the full manifestation of God's heart. Therefore, that's the Swayam Bhagavan. That's the original personality of Godhead. Original, you can't say, you know, because everything's eternal, but original in the sense of God himself, fully himself, is the Krishna. Because in that relationship with Radha, the one who has full capacity to love and serve Krishna, the most intense love for Krishna, invokes the fullest opening of the heart of Krishna. So we have this scene here where Krishna is opening his heart. And what is it? His love for his intimate devotees is being manifest. And because they're suffering, he begins to sob. And he begins to sob and roll on the ground. And then his intimate is so. And before you know it, because they are, when you love someone, you take their heart, you take their emotions. Dwarka, where Krishna is the king, everyone is crying and crying. And because Krishna is in a difficult situation, then it appears inauspicious and there's bad omens. And Lord Brahma is the chief executive officer of the universe, the creator of the universe. Lord Brahma now has come to see what's happening, and it's a very, very startling point that he finds this person whom he worshipped as God and his guru in an unprecedented state, distressed in love for his devotees. And then the verse says, seeing revealing his true greatness normally hidden, Brahma was astonished, and he lost his gravity, and he began to cry. And Brahma is learned. When you're learned, you generally don't cry. You have Dhyan, you can control the emotions. He's crying. True greatness remains hidden. It remains hidden. and he's revealing it, then it's normal again. And what is that? It's loving dealings, which are not in display when he is taking the position as the supreme ruler. So Brahma is shocked. It's so deep, he's never saw this beauty before, but he brings him under control and starts thinking how to restore his lord to normal. And then this idea comes, and when Brahma came riding Garuda, Garuda was crying at Krishna's side because he's a devotee, and he calls him loudly, and then he succeeds, and then Brahma speaks. And Brahma says, and he reveals his idea. There is another Sri Vrindavan here between right at the hill and the sea. So Dwarka is on the sea, so right near there. And Nanda, Yasoda, and others are present within it in replica images with similar herds of cows. That Vrindavan constructed by Vishwakarma appears just like Vrindavan. The Vrindavan of Mathura come here to Dwarka. So this is my plan. There's a place that's a duplicate to the detail. So carefully take Krishna and his brother, he's saying to Garuda, in their present state, gently carry there, but only Rohini should go with them, no one else, because the plan would be, because Krishna's in separation from Vrindavan, and that's why he's crying, to bring him to new Vrindavan, and try to awaken him, and in that emotional state, he'll see these exact replicas of the loving residents of Vrindavan, and he'll get into his Vrindavan bhav of being in union with the residents of Vrindavan, and gradually he'll come out of his stupor. So they're lifelike, these images there. It's practically indistinguishable from the original, down to the smallest detail of plant and life. All the different flowers and things. Vrindavan has many, many different flowers. Ashoka Vikshavala Rivatana Mandapastate Pravala Valapa. It has Ashoka trees, very beautiful. Ashoka Vikshavalari, Vitan Mandapastate, they create like flower houses and Kadambi. So advised by Brahma, everyone went back home. Meanwhile, as Krishna and Balaram were being carried by Garuda, Balaram more or less regained consciousness. Upon arriving at Nava Vrindavan, Garuda and Balaram gently placed Krishna on a bed. The gopis and gopis of Nava Vrindavan stood around him as if they were Krishna's real cowherd men and women. So they put him in this duplicate forest, and they surround him with all these images of the cowherd boys and calves. The cowherd boys and the gopis. Uddhava came there with Devaki, who dearly loved her son, and also Rukmini, Satyabhama, and other queens in Padmavati. They simply couldn't leave Krishna in such a state, so at Brahma's request, they hid themselves and took up position some distance away from where they can see Krishna. So if the idea there is to give Krishna at least temporarily the idea that he's back in Vrindavan, then these queens of Dwarka have to hide. He can't see them, so that's what they do. Narada, however, thinking he had committed an offense, did not accompany the demigods and the Yadavas. Instead, with great curiosity, he hid himself in the midst of the sky, fixing himself in a yoga sitting posture to observe the Madhurya Cheshta, Madhurya Bhagavat, the sweet activities. And what are sweet activities? Sweet activities is where love is exchanged intimately. It's not sweet when you're dealing with someone who is vastly superior, because it's mixed with reverence and some type of fear. There's some type of distance. When there's worship of God and full cognizance of God, there's two things. There's three things. One thing is, there's a sense of obligation or duty in the relationship, and obligation or duty is slightly antithetical to pure attachment and love. You love Krishna, but you have to serve him. And because he's a superior, there's some type of fear. And because he's a superior in the relationship, there's some type of distance. So that's not madhurya. That's not sweetness. That's why Vrindavan, I explained this before, the devotional feelings and the exchanges among the people, it's such a far cry from something like the protocol of, you know, the church and the Pope. Really, if it's really rag mag, spontaneous devotion, the relationships are a little bit more intimate, a little bit more informal. And what to speak of the approach to the divine, it has a natural sweetness that you can feel in terms of the songs and the moods of the song. Radhe Jaya Jaya Madhava Dayate Gokula Taruni Mandala Mahite Radhe Jaya Jaya Madhava Dayate. All the songs. Shama Gauri Nitya Kishori Pitamajori Sirahe Rasita Rasilo Rasita Rasilo Chaila Chabilo Gunadara Vilo Sri Krishna Jaya Radhe Jaya Radhe Radhe Jaya Radhe Jaya Sirahe Pranapriyari Rupa Ujari Atisikanwari Sri Krishna Navanavarangi Navaratri Bangi Shyama Suvangi Sri Krishna Jaya Radhe Jaya Radhe. It's a different kind of mood of sweetness. So Narada, however, thinking he had committed an offense, did not accompany the demigods and the Yadavas. Instead, he was observing the sweetness of the Lord's act. That's the point that he's making. But also, Narada, it says, is Narada who had made Krishna so unsettled in mentioning the present state of the Vrindavati. He initiated that. So as a sensitive Vaishnava, he's feeling something. He's feeling maybe he's committed an offense. And Bhurijan Prabhu asked a very nice question. When the devotees, even the pure devotees, are feeling, when they're feeling that they're so low and they have so many bad qualities, are they finding something, or are they imagining it, or is Krishna putting them there? But the concept is that when your heart is pure and clean, and you're in a very, very humble mood, where you're free from rationalization and intelligence in the service of the false ego, our intelligence is militantly trying to interpret the world to keep up our sense of superiority. And therefore, when one is in that consciousness, even when there's a fault, the intelligence will function to rationalize that that fault or that mistake someone made is not really their fault. Intelligence is serving. And when you have egotism, intelligence just serves that egotism. But the pure devotee, he doesn't have that. That's not how his intelligence is trained. Because his objective is not the ego. His objective is not to be the enjoyer and controller. His objective is to serve Krishna. And that's how his intelligence works, or her intelligence works. It functions in that way. So a really great Vaishnava, he doesn't mind the humble position. He doesn't mind the humble position. And if someone criticizes him, it's not against his bhava. It's not against the thing that he cherishes, which is devotion to Krishna. And in fact, sometimes he appreciates that because it keeps down potentially the ego that can rise to the level to impede the feelings of love and devotion. So when a devotee is sometimes criticized, rather than the ego and the intelligence defending, he just folds, yes, I'm so sorry, I'm a fallen soul. And again, it's so much different than a lack of false, a lack of self-esteem. Because when you have a lack of self-esteem, you're feeling low, but you're feeling bad because you so much desire the position of enjoyer and controller. One who is truly humble, he may see his faults, but he's not desiring to be the lord and controller. He may see his faults in relationship to not being a good enough servant of God. But a person, his heart is very clean. You see this often, like a water, glass of water is very clean. Every spot, speck of dirt can be seen so clearly. Becomes more apparent. On a white sheet, a stain is seen. Lord's heart is like a white sheet. So those are the most egotistical and have the most faults are the people that are least likely to see them. And whether is it made up or not, it doesn't matter. Because it's the person's bhav, it's the person's devotion, it's the person's heart. And it serves his heart to be humble. Because humility is the position by which love can flow. Love cannot flow through the heart that is proud. Because the proud heart never feels kindness. Because the proud heart has such a sense of entitlement that no matter what they get, they never think it's enough, and therefore they never feel it is love. So the humble heart is so he's in that position, he's very satisfied. And therefore anything apparent fault, they can take it upon themselves. Raghunath Das Goswami was so austere, when he was taking just some few drops of buttermilk, he so lacked a sense of entitlement. He so much understood that everything is the grace of God. That the littlest thing that he got and the littlest advantage he took, he magnified, "Oh, I'm such a devout Jew for taking this." So Narada, we see Vaishnav heart. He's sensitive to the fact that he may have offended Krishna by bringing up this question. Even in the world, ordinary person of character is the one who's sensitive to their faults. Sensitive to how they're dealing with others. So this is the position of Narada. Garuda positioned himself even higher in the sky, invisibly following his master to provide shade with his wings. So everything is love. So Garuda loves Krishna, so he's flying in the sky. After a few minutes, Krishna's brother came back almost to normal consciousness, that best of discerning thinkers understood the entire situation. So Balan immediately, so intelligent, that, oh, this is intelligent plan by Lord Brahma to wake up Krishna. Balaram quickly cleaned his own lotus face and that of his younger brother. Then he gently placed a flute in the waist of Krishna's dhoti. A buffalo horn and a stick in Krishna's hand. A garland of kadamba flowers around his neck. How opulent, these yellow, fragrant kadamba flowers. A peacock feather ornament on his head. And newly fashioned rings of gunja berries on his ears. Gunja berries are these plants that they give these beautiful white, black, and red seeds. And you string them together, and it's just a very permanent type little garland of seeds. That was one of Krishna's most favorite things. So they dress Krishna so that he will awaken. And by looking at all the gopis and gopas and seeing himself, he'll think, oh, I'm actually in Vrindavan. Thus, having arranged a forest outfit for Krishna with items made by Vishwakarma, Balaram, with some effort, lifted Krishna and then spoke to him loudly. While dressing Krishna for the forest, Balaram also dressed himself. The special items required went native to Vraja and unavailable in Dwarka, but Vishwakarma, who had at his disposal all the creative skills of the demigods, had made convincing substances for real kadamba flowers, gunja berries, and so on. These are udipin. These are inspirations, because Vrindavan is that place of beauty that facilitates Krishna and his intimate exchanges with his devotees. So all the things were duplicated. I'm going to stop here, because actually now it's an hour later at night, and I can't give an hour and a half class because it would get too late. But would anyone like to ask a question?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Gail.
Gail, Hare Krishna, Gail.
Yeah, I was wondering if, was it a specific offense that Narada felt he had made?
Krishna was upset because he had come there. He had come there, and he was the instigator for this whole discussion about the suffering of the gopis, because he came and glorified Uddhava as the greatest devotee. And then Uddhava started talking about, I'm not a devotee. Look at the residents of Vrindavan, you know, and how they're feeling in separation from Krishna. And then everyone else started to talk about the residents of Vrindavan, because the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, it's Narada's search is searching for this, the most intense love. In separation, they're devastated. They're in such a, it's going to be revealed that they're in such a devastating state from separation from Krishna that he can't even go back, because he'd have to stay with them for a while to help them recuperate. And at the point where they gain half consciousness and are still in a very confused emotional state due to their separation from Krishna, they'll see him and a thought may come to their mind that maybe he'll leave again. And then, like, relapse is always worse. So he's hearing about their suffering, that they're even sorry that Krishna cleaned up the Kaliya River, because it would have been a great facility to just drown themselves or drink the poison. So Narada is the one that instigated all this, and he's just feeling terrible. He came to the palace. Krishna was already feeling bad. He was in his bed lying down with his cloth over his head, and then he instigated this whole discussion, and now he's seeing his lord and master rolling on the floor in agony, and he's just completely devastated. I know a family, and the son is a doctor, and the father got ill, and the son treated the father, and the father almost, he got worse, and he almost got near death, and then the son felt, well, because I treated him, you know, that's natural to feel that way. What an offense I've committed. You know, he may not have done, he may have given the right thing, it just that may have happened. Okay, Gail?
Yeah, I guess it's too late to squeeze in another one, right?
Go ahead, squeeze in another one. You've been so good for so many months now, Gail.
Yeah, Krishna's Bhava manifestation is really none different from, you know, from him. So, I mean, I guess he's not there physically with the gopis, but he is present in his Bhava manifestation. And
no,
so,
but he is, because there's different, and this is very esoteric, but, you know, separation from God is a matter of consciousness. So
right?
If there's deep love because of separation, then they're there, but they're there not in the manifest, what's called the uppercut, the unmanifest.
Yeah.
Because Vrindavan has those two divisions. It has the astika lila smar and the activities that are always going on. And then Krishna appearing. So he's manifest in that way. And they're relating him to, in the manifest way. But when they have that separation, they're with Krishna. That's the understanding that a Vaishnava that goes into a deep meditation on Krishna, it's not just that he's imagining things. He can enter into the internal lila of Krishna. And it's not that it's a concept that's beyond time. It's not that there's ever a time where Krishna's lilas are not manifest somewhere. So they always have access to that. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point the mood of a devotee. In his practice is the mood of separation. He can identify that he's not with Krishna, but the deeper his attachment grows, the deeper his separation grows, and the deeper his separation is, the more his love intensifies. Okay, Gail.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody else like to say hello?
Gurmash, it's Johnny Tai here. My recent is always fun.
Hey, how are you, Johnny Tai?
Do I have time for a question? Okay. I know it's late, and I wanted to especially say thank you for, you know, keeping the same time and staying up, and, you know, I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, yeah, ask a question. Go ahead.
It's sort of a follow-up on this point you were making in response to Burijan Prabhu's question. Because, you know, okay, so I get that, okay, someone, right, like I clean my house, and then, right, just something little's out of place, and it seems like, oh, that's a big problem. Whereas before, everything was a mess, and so it was a little problem. Yeah. But still, there's this question of a devotee thinking, oh, I'm the most, you know, I'm the most fallen, I'm the lowest. Because it still seems objectively that there's some reality that, okay, well, what about the murderer? What about the rapist? What about the, you know, whatever it is. So how does that square up against sort of objective reality?
Because this is how you feel and this is how you think. It's just like a very advanced devotee, right? Like Prabhupada's the guru, but he's not in the consciousness, I am better than everyone. He's in the consciousness, you know, it actually says that. He's just in a mood of devotion. And a mood of devotion automatically invokes such a deep sense of humility. So that becomes a reality to the person. And because that's a reality to the person, that actually in relationship to Krishna, they see the greatness of Krishna, they see the relative insignificance of a living entity, you know, and there's an emotion that's invoked, right? And that becomes like a reality where one sees the world. But that's why it says that someone who is the topmost devotee to preach, he has to become the middle devotee. Because the topmost devotee is seeing everyone serving Krishna better than him. So how can the person preach? But the Madhyamadhikari, specific qualifications is, he worships the Supreme Lord, he makes friends with the devotees, he helps the innocent, and he avoids the inimical. He makes distinctions. But so how does that happen? It means everything is done for service. When there's need for service to come to that platform and make distinctions, then Prabhupada's going to chastise the student or correct the student, right? Take the superior role, and he's going to see that way for service. That's not the mood of devotion that he stays in one sense. And then Prabhupada was often like that, seeing that, you know, you're all sent by my Guru Maharaj. He had those kind of feelings. But to, you know, to teach. But it's kind of, he doesn't have to come to the analytical. In other words, when he needs to come to that platform to take the role of a teacher, he does. But otherwise, he keeps in that mood, that very, very humble mood, where love is flowing through your heart, and you're really just, it's a subjective feeling. It's not an analytical feeling, but it's a feeling of love and devotion. You're so much experiencing the mercy of God, it makes you very, very humble. And not only that, you have such a strong desire for Krishna that it creates a feeling of lack of Krishna. The more devotion you have, the more you want Krishna. And the more that want is there, the less you think you have. So it says that someone who is praying, you know, they don't feel that they have that. They don't feel like they have Krishna. I would like to, if I could think of just a practical, you know, kind of analogy or something to explain that just in common terms, you know. Um, Yeah, you know, maybe someone has a relationship with a very powerful, great, you know, person, right? And in relationship to that person, they like to feel like just a child. And let's say it's a great guru, right? They're patting them on the head. They may go into a mood that I'm just a little child, you know, because they're relishing it so much, right? So they're keeping in that mood, but it may not be the objective reality, right? But it may be the feeling that they have that they're enjoying within that relationship, which is another reality. Is a great, very powerful guru, and then they may be patting someone on the head. And then the person's feeling so much mercy that they like to feel childlike. They like to feel very, very humble. Because it's giving them so much pleasure and devotion. So they don't want to, at that time, analyze, because they're feeling something very significant, which is the mercy of Krishna. And they're feeling Krishna's greatness, and they're feeling Guru's greatness. And they're feeling their love as anugraha, or mercy that's descending upon them. And therefore, they feel so much like being the object of mercy, not the independent, self-sufficient person. But that may be the objective reality, but they'd rather shed that reality. But then let's say something happens, they're feeling like that, you know, and then some people attack the temple, you know, and they have to protect their guru. Then they may even take the superior position. They'll come to that position. So I guess it's the devotion. Whatever their, you know, service is, then they'll have that mood. Okay?
Yeah, no, that's helpful. I was also thinking, as you were thinking about a practical, you know, example, yeah. I was also thinking about like a great athlete or something. You know, someone may say, oh, you're the best ever, and they're thinking, you know, they're honestly thinking, oh, I have so much more that I could do, that I want to do. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing that. And so, yeah, it's their mood. Yeah. They're not even thinking about this other sort of aspect of sort of their
place
in
history.
That's a nice
example. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. A very nice example. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Gilmarch. Thank you.
Okay, good. Okay. Anybody else have to say hello? Yeah, Mooney.
It's Mooney. I wanted to say hello and thanks for staying up late. So instead of us staying up late, I guess, or allowing us to stay up a little later. But thank you for for the class. A lot of questions came to mind, but I really, maybe I'll just send you, you know, given the time and stuff, so we can think about right?
Okay.
I mean, it's probably...
Maybe you said...
Okay.
I don't mind. I mean, I'm okay. It's not that late.
Well,
it's only quarter to 9 here at night.
May I continue it?
Yeah.
There's a lot I had, and I may email you some of the other ones anyway, but I can humbly reveal my mind, I've never been entirely satisfied with the traditional answer that someone who's that exalted comes down to the level of Madhyama, because the precondition for deciding to preach is that you already know that you're in a better place than them. So it seems to me, it's hard for me to understand exactly how one goes from this position of the heart to the position of the head, unless you're already enough in the head to make the distinction that it's the right thing to do. So there's ways in which I find it a very, I don't know, it's a hard thing to answer, but I don't really, we often say that, but I don't exactly understand why. Do you see what I'm saying, Marge? It's like if we say,
not really, I don't see what's
okay.
Difficult to
so understand. There's an Uttama Bhagavata who sees everyone as better than him or her, and then she realizes she wants to preach, and so to do so, she now comes to the position of discriminating. I do objectively know more about this tradition than you, or I have been practicing longer, and you're wrong about this.
Yeah.
But if to come to the position of preaching is to make a decision. And to make a decision, he or she would already have to believe that he or she knows enough to do that, or is qualified enough to do that.
Well, you know, maybe objectively they do know, you know, but it's kind of covered by their sentiments. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, okay.
They objectively, they do know. but it's kind of covered by their sentiments, and they get more and more into their sentiments. And because they're really experiencing the greatness of God and seeing their relative dependence on God and feeling the love that that invokes, it creates a bhava or a mood that they dwell in. But if they're called to do, you know, to make distinctions, they get out of that mood to service, because it's not, you know, it no longer functions for them in terms of service.
Okay, that makes sense. Could I mean, something struck me about this that I think may be relevant, but again, given time constraints, I could save it. I think a reason why I always found this hard to understand is that I tend to be conditioned with the idea that, you know, there's really just our ideas about the world that are important, and the sentiments are somehow just supposed to be, like, subsumed by the ideas that we have of the world, by our, you know, our gyan or whatever. And when I study, I had mentioned previously, like, Aristotle's ethics, Aristotle really makes a powerful point that in ethical life, our sentiments are really the judge of whether or not we're attaining real virtue. And I think sometimes there could be this conflict between our objective view of things and our sentiments, and the sentiments don't have to be seen as illusion. You know, they could just be seen as an appropriate response to the situation, even if it doesn't go exactly in line with our intellect. So I'm just kind of agreeing with the example you gave of, like, saving your food from the fire.
I think that's a very good example. Yeah. You know, it's hard without realizing that, you know, actually feeling that. But I can have a sense of it, that there's certain moods where humility is just so favorable to your perception and mood and relationship to God that you kind of swim in it or immerse yourself in it, you know, and that's like your experience. And, you know, the experience just, I think what it is the experience just becomes projected, which often happens, you know. It kind of colors your view of everything. You know, you're so much in a humble mood that you don't want to see yourself in any other relationship to anything else, because it's such a devotional mood to feel that way, that when you see anything else, it just projects your mood. And it's described, you know, they have these things of Krishna where, you know, even Krishna himself, when he sees the ocean, the churning of the ocean, he sees the love of the, you know, the ocean, or the ocean's water, you know, kind of comes on the shore, like offering, you know, to his feet, or, you know, it's something like that. But anyway, I think that point we can dwell on, that when someone has a particular mood that satisfies them, they'll try to project that mood in relationship to everything, you know. And it's the same thing with I'm superior, right? When someone has an egotistical thing and thinks he's better than everyone, right, then he'll be in that bothering relationship to everything, you know.
Right.
Even when he's not. Yeah.
Or he'll choose to avoid those people that remind him that he's not superior, and he'll stay around those who only remind him that he is. Sorry, excuse me.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, Mooney,
well,
thanks. But anybody,
thank you.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Anybody
thank
else you. Like to say hello?
Hello, Maharaj. Hello.
Hey, Mother and Johnny. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna,
you have such a nice yearning voice. I think it's good for bhakti. Thank you, Mother Johnny.
Thank you.
Anybody? Thank you. Can't hear you so good, but anybody else want to say hello? I can't hear you so good. You're very broken up.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hi, Krishna.
I hear Henry. Hi, Bo. Great.
Cool.
Very nice. Always nice to hear from you, Henry. Always thinking of my visits to your place. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare
Krishna Maharaj, Vijay Krishna, Hamala Vishnu. Thank you, Hare Krishna. Very good. And someone else is saying hello. Who is that?
It's Prem Bhakti.
Prema, Hare Krishna. You still up in the Sun Falls? Okay.
Yeah.
I heard there was a nice Govardhan Puja. That's nice to hear.
Yeah. Yes, the news travels
Thank you.
Fast.
What's that?
I said the news travels fast.
Well, it just happens that I was on the email with Kirtan Ross.
Oh.
For some legal matters. So he wrote me that.
Okay.
Yeah, and he was there. Okay. Thank you, Prema. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hi, Krishna Maharaj. It's Chris in Pennsylvania.
Chris, we'll see you soon, huh?
Did she contact you yet, Leela? I have not heard from her yet, no.
Anyway, I was on the phone with her. When are you leaving?
I leave the 16th. The 16th,
okay.
A week.
Yeah. Yeah, I just spoke to her. I mean, she was out of town. She'll contact you. I'll make sure of it. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. It's back to Carl.
Carl. Hare Bo.
Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. I've got to get back to you
because I know you're coming soon also in January.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Looking forward to it.
Hare Bo.
Yeah. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Is that Chaitanya Priya?
Yes, it is. Hare Krishna.
Hare Bo. Thank you. Anybody else?
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. This is Govardhan Bhaktada.
Hare Bo, Govardhan. Hare Krishna. Thank you. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay. Thank you all. Once you couple through this, Kakasundi, the Chakrafikan, and Pagan, and your life, and